Hi, this is Lee Plave of Plave Cook, and you're listening to Social Geek Radio.
Welcome to Social Geek Radio, brought to you by Franchise Foundry and Minolto Social Media Management. Here are your hosts, Deb Evans and Jack Munson.
Good evening, everyone. This is Social Geek Radio, and this is Deb Evans coming to you live from Houston, Texas.
And Jack Munson with Minolto coming to you live from Chicago. How you doing tonight, Deb?
I'm doing well, but you know, the whole time change thing just makes everything seem later, darker than usual. But all is good. You
right.
Know, it's gonna be winter time, whether we like it or not. Cold
yeah.
for you, not happens, so much for me.
Happens every year about this time.
Happens every year.
And speaking of time changes, I want to introduce my friend Chris Adams, who's on with us tonight on Social Geek Radio. And Chris and I live in about the furthest parts of the world as two people possibly can, yet we seem to communicate every week. How are you doing today, Chris?
Very good, Jack. Very nice to meet you, Deb.
Hi, Chris. And yeah, you know, it's so funny that across the world, but here we are. Just it sounds like you're in the next room. That's just
I'm actually time traveling because it's actually Monday here. A beautiful late spring day in Brisbane, Australia. In addition to all the stuff we talked about, we have some time traveling going on.
Yeah, that's great. Actually, hey, you could tell us how the World Series ends. So we'll get to that. We'll get to that shortly. But I really wanted to have Chris on Social Geek Radio this week for a couple of reasons. One is he's got some amazing stories to tell with really an amazing past in entertainment and digital marketing. But mostly we got together about a week ago at the CMO Summit, which this year was in Orlando. And we had a great time speaking with some CMOs from across the country and across the globe about some brand new things happening in social media. And it was just a fantastic time. And I learned a lot from a lot of the other presenters there. But Chris, before we get into that, tell us a little bit about your background. You've worked at everywhere from Facebook to Amazon to Hollywood studios. How would you sort of describe all of that put together?
I always like to use my wife's description of my career. And what she always says is that I tripped and fell into the right places with the right people at the right time. And certainly that's not taking anything away from the great, you know, blessings I've had. But really, it was a career that started off in writing. I did my graduate work in English literature and in writing, and started off my career as a writer, whether it was a journalist or writing on television or writing for newspapers. And really, that was the way that I wanted to go forward. But due to some very bizarre turns of fate, I happened to get a gig with Columbia TriStar back in the mid-90s, writing on a television show called Annette, which was based on that Sandra Bullock movie of the 80s. And long story short, you know, I called up my best friend from when I was 3 years old, who was the founder of, or the CTO of Lycos, the big portal that was taking on Yahoo back in the day.
Sure.
I said, hey, I got this gig in television. They said, that's wonderful. And I said, yeah, that's great. Well, he said, what's it about? And I said, well, it's a show called Annette. And he said, that's awesome. And I said, well, yeah, the only problem is I don't know what the net is. So, you know, I was a long-haired surfer writer on Venice Beach, and so he described the internet to me using Lycos as an example, and of course I thought that that's what the internet was. So I wove Lycos into the plot of the show, and, you know, the good guys use Lycos to find the bad guys, and I thought it was being very clever, and the show got really good ratings, and, you know, and in all of their wisdom, Columbia TriStar ended up canceling the show. Right as the internet was booming, right as everything was taking off. And I got a call from then CEO Bob Davis to say, you know, we really liked that product placement you did for us. And I thought, yeah, product placement. Yes, of course, product placement. Yes, yes, that's exactly what I intended. And so he ended up hiring me to run entertainment-focused business development for the company. So I went out and did a bunch of deals and across portals and across studios, and, you know, trying to weave the Lycos value proposition of many people against entertainment content. And that led to doing something similar with Amazon when they were music, movies, and books. I was music and movies. So I had to go out and convince publishers to take their CDs and DVDs, and instead of sending them to Walmart exclusively or, you know, Blockbuster Video or Virgin Records or whatever, to try out this new thing called e-commerce. And it was fun. It was an amazing time. You know, we did deals with, one of the signature deals is we did a deal with DreamWorks where we got Gladiators, Saving Private Ryan, Ants 2, and American Beauty all around their Academy Awards for 30 days ahead of Walmart, which is the first time ever a online e-tailer had beat a brick-and-mortar company. And they had a pretty good month, a pretty good quarter. That led to me meeting a lot of people. And one of those people I met was the CEO of Jeff Skoll, one of the founders and first presidents of eBay, of his private family office, who was really looking to, in his words, leverage the power of the media to inspire social change. And what that means is that there are plenty of movies that actually have, they're about something. In the past, you would think about things like Schindler's List or Philadelphia or Aaron Brockovich. Traditionally, the studios would market those movies, you know, Aaron Brockovich as Julia Roberts in a push-up bra. You know, and then when you find out the movie's actually about a single mom who was taking on a chemical company and was poisoning the water, then the studios come in and say, yes, well, that's what we meant all along. We're all about social action.
Right. In award season, we're all about that. But in the middle of summer, we're all about, you know.
Exactly. And so what it really came down to is that Jeff put his money where his mouth is and said, look, we're going to equity finance films that should be made that studios traditionally don't make, and we're going to partner with charities. And basically, the movies become giant commercials for social change and action. And so while I was there, we did such movies as An Inconvenient Truth and Syriana and North Country and Good Night, Good Luck and Charlie Wilson's War. And the company is, you know, thriving and still in existence today. Did Lincoln a couple of years ago, did The Soloist, has made a lot of those movies that are the signature social change movies.
Yeah, you guys really built on something there, because they're still going quite strong.
It really was. It was the rise of, you know, what we liked to call back then filmanthropy. You know, the company was, it was a for-profit company, but Jeff's goal, particularly in the early days, was sustainability, right? So we're going to put money into commercial vehicles that would help nonprofits. And so from there, you know, again, having met lots and lots of people, I got a call from a bunch of guys, actually, that I worked with at Amazon, who had just joined this this nascent little social network called Facebook. And in 2006, I was brought in to help them put video on the site. There was no video, and Mark's brief to me was, well, make it Facebook-y. So I, with a bunch of TV people, I kind of thought, what does that mean? So with a bunch of TV people, we came up with the idea of doing a user-generated content hybrid reality show where we would ask questions on Facebook to people, you know, things like who am I and what makes me laugh and biggest heartbreak. I mean, very esoteric things. They're very personal. And then we would get their videos and stitch them together. And we ended up creating 8 episodes of linear TV that was distributed day on date online through Facebook and Comcast VOD and the Independent Film Channel. And it ended up launching the share button, which is interesting. You know, so it was a piece of, you know, it was a content play that created the now ubiquitous nature of video on Facebook that actually launched a piece of tech that has defined an era.
Right.
And so along the way, I had married an Australian, and it was only a matter of time before I was coming down here. So I moved down into Australia in 2009, and since then have been working with all sorts of companies, whether they're high-growth tech companies and digital companies to startups, generally at the board, advisory board, and digital consulting and strategy consulting level.
Wow. Great. Well, let's actually start with a couple of questions about something you were just talking about with Facebook and video.
Sure.
It seems like Facebook, video on Facebook has just exploded, and not just in the past couple of weeks, but the past couple of months, and it's just grown exponentially every day. When was the last time you saw someone share a YouTube link on Facebook and actually clicked on it, right? That seems to be...
Yeah.
Now, that seems to be so 2014, right? So where do you see this going? Is the native video on Facebook now just completely taking over video viewing habits?
Look, I think I think that that is certainly, you know, the trend. I mean, there's these incredible stats out there, like 4 billion videos are viewed a day on Facebook, and, you know, 65% of them are on mobile. And look, I think that Facebook has done a remarkable job in their overall growth and how video plays into that strategy. You know, if you really look at it, YouTube's getting its lunch eaten on both sides. You know, it's got Netflix on one side and it's got Facebook on the other. And
right.
Facebook has really become the place where short form video is having more traction. And I think that has a lot to do with the platform. I mean, like it or love it, YouTube, in my opinion, is just a very inelegant platform. Right.
Yes.
It's a hell of an idea. Right. And
right.
It was groundbreaking back in the day. And really, there hasn't been a lot of innovation to that platform that I can see. I mean, I'm very confident that there's been thousands of engineers, you know, working feverishly in a hive-like mentality on making the YouTube experience better. But what we've really seen is them experiment across a number of different business models, none of which have taken traction. I mean, whether they are trying to get into the Netflix space or, you know, they've been overrun by commercials and by music video. I mean, YouTube seems to be suffering from a lack of identity.
Right.
And Facebook, I think, has naturally come in and said, look, you know, more and more people are sharing video on Facebook. You know, our acquisition of Instagram and the implementation of video, which was, you know, very much, I believe, a direct response to Vine. Although it's very tactical, it's also very natural. I mean, you're on Facebook all the time. So I think that it's going to get bigger. And I think that their challenge and I think their goal is how do they monetize it?
Right.
And whether that becomes Facebook becoming a media company, which I personally, not any insider information, but that's just my personal view on where Facebook is going. You know, I can see them potentially acquiring some gigantic multinational, multi-billion dollar entertainment brand in the next, you know, short amount of time, you know, a couple of few years, or they turn it into a big advertising platform, or both. I just think that video and Facebook is going to get bigger. And I think that whether it subsumes YouTube or not is not really the question. I think it's that how does Facebook eventually eat the world in terms of video and in
right.
terms of potentially entertainment?
Right. Yeah, YouTube appears to be more and more, it's a great advertising platform. There's a lot of ads happening there. There's a lot of dollars going to those ads. But it really appears to be a giant library. You know, it's the repository where if you've got a video, have it there because someone will see it sometime. But there's not really engagement happening there, you know, and there's not.
Well, that's right. I don't think it's contextual.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what YouTube has really suffered with is contextuality and social. I mean, it's one thing to be able to start a channel and then grow lots of users and then share. But YouTube has struggled to be a destination in and of itself. I mean, it's not a social network. I mean, Facebook is the social network, and there are lots and lots of others out there, but it's still the biggest. And with its acquisitions of, you know, WhatsApp and Instagram and all of those types of things, it's actually acquiring other social networks and messaging platforms where it's just getting eyeballs. And it's owning those users in a very deep way. And I think that it is, I think you're right. I mean, YouTube is a directory, whereas Facebook is very contextual.
Yeah. And back to my point about sharing links to YouTube videos on Facebook, I just did a little bit of an experiment today. I had posted a video to the Social Geek Radio Facebook page. I posted a link to a YouTube video a couple of days ago, and it got maybe a couple of likes. Nothing very exciting, no comments or anything. I posted the exact same video. I uploaded it today, just a couple of hours ago, to the Social Geek Radio Facebook page as a native video. And it already has 300 views and several likes and a few shares. And that's on a Sunday afternoon, right? So, you know, there's obviously something more attractive, at least to our geeky fans of the Social Geek Radio page, for that native video that, you know, as soon as they scroll past it, it starts playing, right? As opposed to what looks to be kind of a clunky looking link back to YouTube. And Chris, like what you said, YouTube really doesn't look any different than it did 3 years ago. I mean, I know they're doing, they must be doing a ton of stuff with the search algorithms and, you know, being able to find things seems to be a much different experience than it was, but the actual sitting and viewing a YouTube video, you know, it really is the same as it was just a few years ago.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And speaking of advertising and YouTube and Facebook, tell me your thoughts on what we're seeing with native ads on the social channels versus online ads. And particularly what I see as a huge opportunity is all of the ad blocking that everyone seems to be doing on their mobile devices now. You know, if you look at the App Store, three of the top five or six apps being downloaded right now are ad blockers. So that tells me that there's a lot of online ads that are being blocked one way or another, but Facebook, Twitter, other social channels, those ads are not being blocked, right?
Yeah, that's right. And look, I think that what you're seeing is a shift, again, towards more contextuality. I mean, if you look at Facebook's launching of Instant Articles, which is, you know, ostensibly a publishing platform, right? But what it's doing is it's really leaning into the space of kind of advertorials,
yeah,
right? And the line between what is an ad and what is information is being blurred. And whether that was a conscious strategic decision or a response or something else, I don't really think it's important, because I think that you are living on very few places a lot, but you are exposed to a lot of other things. And I think that the more you live on places like Facebook and Twitter and other messaging apps in which the ads are becoming more sophisticated, they're not as annoying as they used to be, right?
Right.
Look at gaming. You know, gaming is now moved from in-app ads to actual rewards. You know, watch this ad for another game that algorithmically you probably will like, and you get, you know, a free life, or you get a whatever, you know, you get some reward. I think that the transactional element of the way advertising is going is really the future. I mean, there's a lot more in-app functionality that we're seeing across social networks. The advertising is becoming much more relevant. And I think that there was a general, you know, four or five years ago, there was a fear that, you know, platforms like Facebook would get to know us, and it was all about privacy. And now, in a world where you accept the fact that, for by and large, these platforms are free, and you are going to be advertised to the degree that those platforms can make it more relevant, to get to know you not just as a demographic, but as an individual, which Facebook is getting really good at.
Yeah.
It's almost becoming just part of the background, right? The ads are being served in a way that is more entertaining, that is more informative, and is less annoying. Now, there's still ads, right? But look at the Star Wars trailer. I mean, that is an ad,
mm-hmm.
right? It just simply is an ad, and it's blown the internet up. Right? Because they made it relevant, because there's commentary around it, because it knows that when I set up my Facebook profile in 2006, I listed one of my favorite movies as Star Wars. Now, everybody in the world is sharing it and all that kind of stuff, but it doesn't feel like an ad to me, right? It feels right. Like something that is relevant to my life that I am excited about. Now, I know that there's monetization going on in the background, but it doesn't annoy me. Like, I don't feel like I'm being spammed. So I think that to the degree that brands can really get more creative and more authentic and more relevant, and they can storytell around their products and services and value propositions and use these platforms and their functionality, like Instant Articles, like native videos, to engage, it's really got to be about a transaction. I mean, like, I would be fascinated to see if you could measure, you know, metrics around how many people saw the Star Wars trailer on Facebook or YouTube or Twitter or whatever, and then immediately went and bought tickets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah. What was that conversion?
There's got to be a goal.
Yeah.
There's got to be a goal. I mean, it used to be spray and pray and hope, right?
Right.
Now it's, you've got to be targeted, and I think that both brands are becoming smarter and the networks are becoming smarter. You know, particularly Facebook. I mean, Facebook is still a very personal experience. So Advertising has to be relevant.
And
well, the consumers are so much smarter today, so the brands have to step up. And
yeah, I think that's right, Deb. I mean, look, you know, I've heard over the decades so many people whinging about ads, right? You know, and everybody has an opinion, right? But I mean, at the same time, I mean, you know, you're being advertised to. You know, you're being data mined. I mean, I think it is very ironic that people complain about ads on Facebook and everything else, and then yet, like, if Facebook ever came out and said, "All right, you know, we're going to make our platform entirely ad free, but it's going to cost you $1 a month," you know, there'd be like revolution.
Right.
You know, completely unjustified, because, you know, probably lose half their users, but then everybody else would pay. And then the people who were paying, who were going, "It's $1 a month, you know, would give their friends crap about it and say, "What, right, you're too cheap to do $1 a month? I think that brands are becoming smarter. I think that Facebook is responding by being smarter or driving innovation. And at the end of the day, I mean, look, guys, it's free. You know,
yeah.
And it's a pretty good service. I mean, and this is me, like, I've had a very tumultuous relationship as the user with Facebook, you know, having been there so early and watching it grow so dramatically and using it in so many ways across, you know, a huge swatch of my life, is really interesting. And I just kind of think, well, guys, you know, what do you want? I mean, it's free and it's useful. So, and if the ads are better, I mean, it knows that I like this, that, and the other thing, and it's only going to advertise in a clever way about those things, well, then I don't really have a problem with it.
Yeah, and I think if they ever went to the premium model and took away the ads, I think there would be a revolution, but I think the revolution would be from advertisers who are finally realizing that, wow, this is really the best bang for my buck right now.
That's right.
We coming up in the next coming weeks on Social Geek Radio, we're going to get really deep into some things like customer audience targeting and some other things, a few other tricks I learned from some great brands and some Facebook folks last week as well. You know, when it comes to the advertising and the native video, and I think where you're going next is, you know, the e-commerce play at Facebook and some of the other social networks. It sounds to me like the days of the corporate website really are numbered. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I really would. And I think it's something that we're going to see. And I mean, this is something that I, you know, that an opinion that I have that's anecdotal. It's not, you know, research driven or anything. But, you know, look, I think that Facebook wants to be the internet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That's my view, is that they just don't see any more use for websites. Right. And if you look at it, you know, 1.5 billion people or whatever it is now. And the fact that they are leaning so heavily into video, so heavily into messaging, and so heavily into brands, that really, why, like, what's the future of WordPress? You know, what's the future of Wix? What's the future of these sites that provide almost an ISP-like environment where, you know, hosting companies, you get your domain and you get your website. I mean, I think that without social and without your brand having a presence on social, whether you like it or not, all right, whether you understand it or not, you have to be there. Because I think that if Facebook is going to kind of eat the world and eat the internet, And look, whether they actually do it or not, their numbers are stacking up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you have to allocate dollars and time and resources and energy against so many different pieces of real estate, right? I mean, it's like you have to be a quote-unquote really big property developer to actually support a robust website anymore. I mean, unless you are purely transactional. But even so, we're seeing the buy button, you know, come on to social networks. We're seeing it being much, much easier to sell directly from Facebook, whether it's a good or service, whether it's coupons, whether it's games, whether it is, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter what it is. I mean, Facebook is becoming a website.
Right, right.
And a web environment. And so I think that they're making these moves consciously, right? And why wouldn't they? I mean, if you've got 1.5 billion people, and you have, and a brand can very simply create a brand page and then add more functionality and more features to it as Facebook grows. I mean, what's the point of having a website unless there's some real special need?
Right. And there's so many people who just, we were talking about this last week, people who just don't go to websites. You know, they either, stay on Facebook, or for some people, maybe it's Instagram. For me, it might be more LinkedIn and Twitter, right? But, you know, people have their social places where they are spending more and more time. No one's spending less time on their favorite social channels these days.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, I was going to ask you, but I think you already gave me the answer, back to the CMO summit that we were at last week. If you had some advice to give to any of the CMOs out there on something they should get on top of right now, it sounds to me like doing something with e-commerce or doing something with a buy button on Facebook would probably be your number one piece of advice. Is that correct?
Yeah, but I think that's absolutely right tactically. But I think that you first got to start out with some strategic thinking, right? And it goes back to storytelling, right? You know, your ability to be creative and authentic, you know, your ability to look at quality and not quantity, you know, expand your offerings, really concentrate on relevance and on ease, concentrate on calls to action that seem normal, right? You know, we've seen so many trends, whether it's hashtags or bit.lys or, you know, short URLs and all that kind of stuff. I think that these things come and go. And ultimately, I think that you have to look at this as real estate, right? Mm-hmm. Your social real estate is your number one communications channel and relationship building channel with your customers. And it might seem like they are audience, but they're not. They're your customers. They're there because they're engaged, and it's your job to transact. So buy buttons and, you know, all those types of things are tools. But unless you really look at your social channels as a communications portal, right, two-way. I mean, I look at social as largely being, for brands, as largely being customer service. Right, it's a way mm-hmm. to engage. It's a way to have conversations. Websites don't do that well.
Right.
But it's almost like, you know, how would you describe your brand, your job, your value proposition to people you meet at a barbecue on a Sunday? Right, that voice, that tone of voice that you use anecdotally, in your real life, is the way you really need to communicate with people on a Facebook or a Twitter or on other social channels. You can't really sell. You have you have to develop trust. You have to develop relevance, and you really have to leverage the power of social recommendation. This is the fact that if you're a good citizen, right? If you're transparent and authentic and creative, and you're telling your story and you're being responsive, people are going to start telling your story for and with you, right? So it's very different than just simply real estate. I mean, you can dress up the front of your house and put a few new bushes on there and slap a coat of paint, but if your plumbing leaks, right, and your back porch is falling apart and your electricity isn't good, nobody's going to buy your house because you slapped lipstick on a pig. Do you feel that?
Right.
You've got to be really systemic. You have to be really authentic, and really organic, and tie all of this stuff together. And I know that that's a very jargon-heavy sentence, but if you contextualize it, it really comes down to how you're telling your story and how you're using this real estate in able to do that.
And that story can happen on social. It cannot happen on a corporate website or on your PowerPoint sales deck, right? It's just, as to put it in your terms, you're using the wrong voice. You're not using the backyard barbecue voice, right? So,
yeah, there are plenty of places in which that very corporate, very sales facing, and or very investor relations is totally appropriate. Mm-hmm. And maybe it means that the future of corporate web is simply IR, you know, and the nuts and bolts of the corporation, whereas the conversation goes on social.
Right, especially for the consumers. Sure. This is Social Geek Radio, and our guest tonight is digital strategist Chris Adams. Chris, in the couple of minutes we have left, tell us about some of the things you're working on now, some of the startups and some of the projects and things that that you're doing every day these days.
Sure. Well, you know, look, as you know, Jack, full disclosure, I'm a director of Monalto, which you're involved with, which, you know, I'm very proud to talk about it in that backyard voice. I mean, I think that what Monalto is doing to help brands engage on a larger scale with greater efficiencies and rigor across social page management is fantastic, and it fits right into, it's very germane to this conversation about how brands can effectively storytell. I mean, you've got to have organization before you can storytell. I mean, you know, Minalto, and to me, is like sentence structure. It's like grammar, right? You know, you understand the basic grammar and syntax and structure before you can write a great story. And Minalto is that, you know, kind of English professor that comes in and gives you the rigor. So I'm very proud to be involved in that company. I'm also involved with a company called Thread, which is unified social messaging. So this is the ability to create private, either one-on-one or group messages across any social network or platform. It's kind of like Reply All on steroids. It allows you to, you know, we all send out stuff to people on email, and then we don't have their email. You know, we know them on, we have their phone number, or we know them on LinkedIn, or we know them on WhatsApp, and we have to, you know, and it's just a big pain in the butt. And if you take that, you know, kind of Reply All meets WhatsApp on steroids, and then add transactions to it. You know, if I wanted to invite you and Deb to have a coffee at a Starbucks in Chicago, well, it bundles all the content together and says, okay, well, we're going to have coffee with these two people that I've connected to on email and LinkedIn. And then we know, we put a map in there on how to get to the coffee. We know we're going to a Starbucks, so it pushes you the ability to buy your coffee, pre-buy your coffee, and then maybe because it knows where you are, it can send you an Uber. You know, things like that. So it's creating, it's a social commerce engine. Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and there's the commerce piece, right. And that's Thread.
The commerce piece. So
Thread, Thread, if anyone's looking.
Yep. Thread. Yet to be launched. There was another Thread out there, so it's not that one. This one's going to be launched later on this year.
Okay.
And look, I mean, I also, there's a company I love, built by an Australian, actually, out of Seattle, called Buddy. And Buddy is an Internet of Things data play, where it kind of sucks in all of the data from all these smart devices and then curates it and makes sense to it, and then is able to distribute it to any form of CMS or CRM or any piece of software you've got, where it's Salesforce or Excel in the other side, because you've got, you know, as the guy Dave McLaughlin, who just did his roadshow here in Australia, he backdoor listed into an Australian company, and just raised a big whack of money down here, you know, just honoring his Aussie roots. You know, people who build dishwashers don't really worry about data, but the people, there are a lot of people who do, and he's got a piece of middleware that sits in the space between those kind of smart devices, which are manufactured, and the people who analyze that data. He's got Microsoft behind him and Bill Gates behind him, and just a really smart guy. And I'm really excited because I see a lot of this Internet of Things thing happening. And unfortunately, in my opinion, a lot of the stuff that's coming out is not really solving problems that people have. You know, like I saw the other day, this $99 device that you plug in and it listens to your smoke detector, and then it rings your phone, right? Which is, I mean, I can understand that if you're out of the house, but you know, you have a $20 smoke detector and then you have a $99 device that rings you. Okay, you know, for the small percentage of people that their house might burn down while they're away, that's useful. But if you're, you know, on the other side of the country, it's not terribly useful other than to make you panic.
Right.
I think that the Internet of Things has a long way to go in terms of its growing up, but to the degree that there are amazing devices out there, I mean, like OnStar, you know, even like, you know, Denon and what they're doing in the streaming space with their wireless HEOS speakers, and, you know, even Philips, you know, what they're doing with their light bulbs. I mean, you might think it's just a party trick, but there's just buckets of data that comes out of that. And Dave McLaughlin and Buddy have really leaned in and created what I think is a wonderful platform around how to make sense of all that stuff.
Excellent. We'll check those companies out as well. And we've got just about a minute left, and I want you to tell everybody about your favorite new pet project coming up, your book.
Ah, yes, my book. Well, as quick as I can, you can imagine with my English literature background, story time and bedtime with my son was full of books. And at a certain point, we read so many books that my son just started telling me to make up stories. And so I would make up stories with him, and we would tell them over and over and over again. And, you know, when you have a 5 or 6 year old at that time as an editor, you get your story right.
That's right.
And so because with my tech background and knowing a lot of people, I started publishing some of the books myself in app form. And I I did a book called Sam the Biggest Fire Truck, and then I partnered with the guy who did Cowboys and Aliens, the graphic novel and the movie, and we did a version of Cowboys and Aliens about the kids. So, you know, while Daniel Craig and Harrison Ford are off saving the world, what are the kids doing? You know, Native American kid and cowboy kid and alien kid, and it was a story about sharing. And then through my work at the Global Poverty Project, I got to know Hugh Jackman, and his kids were reading my books. And I narrated them because they were online. And one day, his kids said, "Well, Daddy, why don't you do that?" And Hugh looked at me and said, "Well, you got another one?" And I said, "Well, actually, I do. Called Dan the Biggest Fire Truck, or Dan the Biggest Dump Truck, sorry." And so, you know, there's a theme. Sam was the biggest fire truck and he couldn't find a home. And then Dan's the biggest dump truck and he couldn't find a home until, you know, all the other diggers and trucks got in trouble and he came to save the day. And luckily, Hugh loved it, and we partnered with the Global Poverty Project and with World Vision, and the proceeds of the book sales are going to go to them to work on their programs in the children's space, and the book will be coming out in the U.S. next spring, so call it the March-April timeframe, in hardback and in ebooks and iBooks. With Hugh narrating. Wow. So it's
very good.
It's really fun. It's really
Dan
really
the
fun.
Biggest so, Dump Truck by Chris Dan the Biggest Hugh Jackman. Wow.
Yeah, you know, narrated by Hugh Jackman.
You know,
that's
very cool. You know, while you were speaking earlier, I was drawing my own little Venn diagram of storytelling crossing over with digital, crossing over with being a good citizen. And I think your book just hit all of those things, right?
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, it was amazing to see my son. I mean, I'll tell you a quick story. It was very funny. When I did my first two books, you know, when they came out in the App Store, because they didn't have physical versions, I said to my son, look, Cooper, look, this is your and Daddy's book. And he's like, it's not a book. Book something you like open the pages with, you know, you sit in bed with. And I'm like, yeah, but you know, you use your iPad. And he's like, look, Dad, that's all great, but it's not a book.
Wow.
Right. So I made sure that with Dan the Biggest Drum Truck and Hugh, we actually got a physical version. So because there is that lovely thing about when you're, you know, you're tucking your kids in at night and sitting on the couch or whatever, and having that physical book, but also having it live on other formats. And I look at it as, you're very correct, Jack, is that storytelling, that is, you know, that's the key. And to the degree that you can use all forms of communications channels, and one of the biggest ones being digital, to promote good citizenship, you know, in addition to learning and, you know, bringing family, you know, children and parents together around a great story. I think that's exactly right. I hadn't actually thought of it that way, but it makes total sense. I'll have to steal that from you.
All right. That is my gift to you in exchange for an autographed copy of your upcoming
you
book.
Bet.
I want one too.
Excellent.
You bet. No problem.
Listen, Chris, thanks so much. Thanks for joining us in Australia, whatever the heck time of the day it is there. And
thank you.
We look forward to having you join us. Having you join us again, perhaps early in the new year, to talk about some trends and some things happening in 2016. And until then, we look forward to your book and all the best.
I love it. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the time, Jack and Deb. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
Okay. All right. Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Bye.